Hi, Marco Werman here. We've heard from so many listeners during this fundraiser about when and where they listen to The World, walking through London during a lunch break, or listening in from Nikiski, a town in southern Alaska, or while sipping morning coffee in Rome, or making dinner, or commuting. The when and where might be different, but the why is often the same, because you care about the world around you, about the stories and events beyond our borders, and about people whose voices are seldom heard. It means a lot to us making the program that you care and that you show your support financially as well. There's still time to make your gift before the end of the calendar year. We need your help to reach our goal. Contribute today and join so many others from every corner of the globe who support our program. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
As the Omicron variant grips more of the world, we're learning more about it. For example, an epidemiologist tells us about a troubling new study out of the UK
that showed an increased level of transmission among household contacts with the Omicron variant versus Delta variant.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on the show, it's been around for a while, but some countries are seriously dialed in to a fuel that may power your car in the future.
I plug it in. It's like on a pistol. Just click it in.
What's the source? We'll head to Belgium to find out. Also, for many people, it is the most bakeful time of the year, cookies especially.
There's something about food memories that just kind of stay with you forever.
Sweetness that travels the globe, all of that and more, today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it here today. As many fear, the Omicron variant of the COVID-19 virus is spreading across the globe. In the UK, people are scrambling to get the booster vaccine, with the government there announcing the first death from Omicron. When Omicron was first identified last month, scientists warned it would take weeks before they could give reliable information about how Omicron affects people. Now some of that data is starting to come out. With us to discuss the data and the latest updates is Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo. She's a leading epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. She joins us from Baltimore. Dr. Nuzzo, what do we know now about the Omicron variant that we did not know a few weeks ago?
Well, we still know very little, but it's becoming a bit more clear as to the concerns posed by this virus. I think the main concern we are starting to see is that this virus is capable of spreading quite easily, and in particular, potentially in a vaccinated population.
Right. So it is pretty transmissible. Are you seeing transmissibility higher in some parts of the world?
What we're seeing in some of the studies that have been done is that this variant may be more transmissible than the Delta variant, which was already challenging because it was more transmissible than the forms of the virus that came before. I think for me, what gives me pause, it was a study from the United Kingdom looking in households that showed an increased level of transmission among household contacts with the Omicron variant versus Delta variant.
In terms of the severity of Omicron, how much more or less sick does Omicron make people in comparison with Delta or the origin COVID-19 virus?
So that's where we don't really have a full set of data yet. So far, we haven't seen a signal that suggests that this variant is particularly more severe. So we're first seeing it in a population such as South Africa, where there's a high level of prior infection, which may be why it's just showing up as more mild than it would otherwise. It may also be the fact that it's circulating in a population that is less prone to severe illness. So people who are younger or potentially with fewer comorbidities, underlying health conditions that could make them more likely to experience severe illness.
So Pfizer announced that its vaccines are only 70% effective against the new variant in terms of getting hospitalized. How effective do you think the vaccines in general are against the variant and just keeping people out of the hospital?
I think the vaccines remain quite protective against keeping people out of the hospital. We know that even before we heard about this variant, that there were certain populations in particular that would benefit from having an additional dose of vaccine because they were more likely to experience severe illness if they were more than 6 months away from their last vaccination. And that was the reason why they were initially prioritized. So people over the age of 65, people who have underlying health conditions, absolutely would benefit from having a third dose. We see those trends continue with respect to variants, although the protection against severe illness is a bit lower than we've seen before. It's still too early to tease out exactly what it means for people who are young and otherwise healthy and how long it's been since vaccination.
So Pfizer has also announced it has a new drug to treat COVID. It's released new data confirming the drug is 90% effective against hospitalization and that it works against Omicron. What do you make of this news?
Well, I think the more treatments we have to treat COVID-19, the better. And having more tools available to people will certainly, I think, help reduce the impact that we see of the virus and this variant.
When do you expect the Omicron variant to start appearing in large numbers here in the U.S.?
Well, we're already seeing an uptick in the percentage of sequences that are coming back as the Omicron variant. And in some places, it's, you know, now up to almost 14% of the number of sequences. So I think, you know, we're probably maybe about a month behind where the UK is, in part because their surveillance is a bit more aggressive than ours. So I would expect over the coming weeks, we're going to see a rapid increase in the percentage of sequences that are coming back as Omicron.
Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is a leading epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health, giving us an update of what we now know about the Omicron variant. She joined us from Baltimore. Dr. Nuzzo, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Scientists say part of a critical ice shelf in West Antarctica could break apart within the next 5 years. What happens with Thwaites Glacier has big implications for future sea level rise. A group of scientists midway through a research project on Thwaites are reporting out their surprising findings this week. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
The front edge of Thwaites Glacier, the part where it meets the sea, is slashed with cracks and crevices. When I saw it on a research expedition almost 3 years ago, these points showed where the glacier might soon cleave, spitting icebergs out to sea. Glaciologist Aaron Pettit has been watching bigger fractures shoot through the eastern part of Thwaites via satellite ever since then. She thinks of them like cracks in your windshield.
Just like the sudden fracturing of your windshield as you go over a bump in the road, I expect that sometime in the next few years, there's going to be a sudden propagation of a bunch of these fractures,
breaking some 400 square miles of ice up into individual icebergs, just like a windshield shattering. Pettit, who's an associate professor at Oregon State University, says this is happening faster than she expected.
It definitely is surprising us.
The fractures are triggered by weak spots created by warm ocean water melting the underside of the floating portion of the glacier.
So this part of the ice shelf is already floating. So the fracturing of this particular part of the glacier won't contribute itself to sea level rise.
But it's still significant. Thwaites acts like a dam, keeping a massive amount of ice behind it on land. Pettit says when the part of the glacier she's talking about breaks apart, it will no longer have that same effect.
What it's doing is releasing a bit of a dam on the ice that's flowing off the continent and into the ocean, and that's the acceleration that will start to contribute more directly to sea level rise.
Thwaites currently contributes about 4% to the globe's annual sea level rise. Pettit says that'll start ticking up in the coming decades. Just how rapidly that occurs depends on what happens to the ice that's left when the floating part breaks away. Anna Crawford at the University of St. Andrews has modeled how quickly marine ice cliffs start to fail. Soon she'll start to apply her calculations to Thwaites.
This area is not retreating through ice cliff failure yet, but we want to know, will ice cliff failure become a factor in the future retreat of Thwaites?
Crawford spoke at a virtual press conference at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union. Ted Scambos, who co-leads the international research effort on Thwaites, said the changes expected in the next few years will not look dramatic.
That's going to look like a bunch of icebergs drifting off to sea.
But what has scientists worried is what could happen in the long term. If Thwaites collapses completely, that could trigger several feet of sea level rise.
It's a bit unsettling, especially standing on the ice and looking onto the ice sheet and seeing that this huge area from one side of the horizon to the other is moving at you at about a mile every year, and all by itself, this one glacier could impact sea level significantly.
Ultimately, Skambos and other scientists are trying to get the most precise estimate they can of just how large that impact will be. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Staying for a bit on the climate change beat, but north in Russia, where the temps hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit in a small Siberian town during a 2020 heat wave. That should be unusual for a place near the Arctic Circle, but the Arctic is warming up. Still, the World Meteorological Organization just declared that 100-degree heat wave in Siberia a new record, a milestone no one should be proud of. This time of year, you may hear people saying, it tastes like the holidays. To me, that means gingerbread and peppermint. Go to another country and that taste is going to change, depending on where you are and what you're celebrating. The World's Bianca Hillier has that story.
Maggie Unzueta grew up in the States, but often traveled back to her family's hometown of Durango, Mexico, for Christmas.
Christmas time was a big deal.
She remembers the kitchen being packed with people making tamales, which are prepared year-round for celebrations and parties. But a few treats only get whipped up in December.
Buñuelos are like just during Christmas time. It's basically a flour tortilla, but sweeter, that's fried and then topped with cinnamon and sugar.
To wash it down, Unzueta says ponche navideño, a Christmas fruit punch, is always served, plus a thick Mexican hot chocolate.
Champurrado is thickened with mazarina. It's a kind of a cornmeal that makes it rich and thick. So it's very traditional to have tamales and your champurrado like together.
Because of the pandemic, Unzueta hasn't spent Christmas in Mexico for a couple of years. But she's made sure to cook all these recipes with her son at home in San Diego.
It's a way to preserve our culture and continue traditions. And there's something about food memories that just kind of stay with you forever.
Pilar Hernandez, born and raised in Chile, is holding on to her own food memories in Houston, where she now lives with her family.
In Chile, it's very traditional to have a buffet of sweets.
The buffet includes a mix of traditional holiday cookies, but the most celebrated dessert on the table is called pan de Pascua. It's a dense fruit cake stocked with nuts and dulce de leche.
It's so popular that any coffee or tea that you are taking during December is going to be with a piece of pan de Pascua.
Hernandez is not kidding. Her mom's recipe makes 8 pounds of batter. And every year, it takes a village to put it all together.
My uncles will come to help mix the batter because it gets so heavy with all the fruit and the almonds and walnuts.
These days, Hernandez scales it back and bakes just one pan de Pascua for her family in Houston. But the meaning is just as big.
I always tell my mom, like, tomorrow we're making the pan de Pascua. It's like, it's still an event. And with the smell, I feel like my grandma and everyone is around me.
Bi Yin Lo can relate to that. She was born and raised in Malaysia, but spent more than a decade in the U.S. Every winter, she would bake Lunar New Year treats to feel festive and closer to home, including a crispy crepe called Love Letters.
It's folded, and then we grill it over charcoal fire using a very special metal mold. And then on the metal mold, you can actually see Chinese writings and the Chinese flowers.
Malaysian pineapple tarts are also on the menu. Despite the name, Yin Lo says it's a cookie with spiced pineapple puree inside.
It's one of those really regional cookies. If I didn't make them, I wouldn't have created the festive mood.
To Iris, Oscar's daughter Vale, a festive mood comes from the smell of warm spices like cardamom.
Food and taste and smell can take you back to a memory. Absolutely.
Her memories are from growing up on a dairy farm in northern Iceland. From a young age, she'd stand next to her mom and grandma to bake traditional ginger cookie sandwiches with vanilla buttercream.
They're called mennukökur, which directly translates as mom cookies. I don't know where that name came from, but yeah, it's a very endearing name.
Now, years later, Oscar's daughter Vale is a mom herself. She runs a bakery in Maine and hasn't been able to see her family in Iceland for years. But on the menu at her bakery this time of year are those beloved Icelandic mom cookies, making her hometown feel just a bit closer for the holidays. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
More stories from around the globe still ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Next week, people in Libya are supposed to be voting for a new president, but it looks increasingly like that election won't happen. Over the weekend, the country's election commission said it could not publish a list of presidential candidates because of legal issues. With just days to go, the uncertainty of a delayed election threatens to plunge Libya back into chaos. The World's Duri Bhaskaran has more.
Anas El Gomati has hope for Libya. There are 2.8 million registered voters, an educated public, and vast oil resources. But he says it's too soon to hold democratic elections. The country is still recovering from a decade of violent upheaval, says Gomati, who founded the country's first public policy think tank, the Sadiq Institute.
There are still mass graves that are being uncovered 50, 60 kilometers from Tripoli. And the very actors responsible for this, or in fact candidates in these elections.
There are three main contenders in Libya's presidential elections scheduled for December 24th. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of the country's former dictator. There's Khalifa Haftar, the army commander that led Gaddafi's overthrow and then plunged the country into two civil wars. And Abdul Hamid Dibiba, the temporary prime minister installed by a UN-led peace process, who promised he wouldn't run.
They are, in a sense, military and tribal-military figures, and they bring the prospect of more war, not more peace, irrespective of if they win or if they lose.
Jalal Harshawi, a senior researcher at Global Initiative, a Geneva-based think tank, says it's been clear for months that these elections will not happen.
The prime minister is deeply interested in making sure that the elections don't happen because he is actually interested in staying in power, and he believes that he has a fair chance.
Harshawi says he's just surprised that it's taken so long for election officials to admit there are problems with the upcoming vote.
The job that needs to be done consists in informing the Libyan public that this year is not going to see any vote happening.
But if the elections don't happen, it's unclear if the current government will be able to stay in power. That's according to Wolfgang Lacher, a North Africa analyst for the German Institute of International and Security Affairs.
If the elections don't happen on the 24th of December, then the Beba's opponents will come out and say, we no longer recognize this government, and they may then form a parallel government.
And if that happens, the fragile ceasefire that has been in place for the past year could collapse, and other problems would follow.
This then threatens potentially the collapse of the economic recovery. It could threaten oil production, which is the mainstay of Libya's economy.
All of this is deeply worrying to Anas El Gomati, head of the Sadiq Institute.
These are not just legal issues or political issues. We're speaking about human life.
People will lose their lives, he says, if Libya fails to achieve a peaceful transition of power. For The World, I'm Duri Bhaskaran.
We're going back to 2019 and that massive fire that badly damaged the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. French officials have now approved a plan to restore the building's Gothic interior. But what's been greenlit is controversial. The plan includes changes that some critics say alter the cathedral's medieval aesthetic. Didier Ricknell is an art historian and founder of La Tribune de l'Art, a French online magazine. He's joined more than 100 French art historians, heritage and architecture experts, artists and writers who've signed a petition objecting to the renovations. So the petition you signed, Didier, says the plan for Notre Dame's interior completely distorts the decor and the liturgical space. Explain how it does that.
The problem is what they want to do inside Notre Dame is to erase more and more Viollet-le-Duc, you know, because Viollet-le-Duc was the architect who restored Notre Dame in the 19th century, and he's a great architect, very well known everywhere in the world. Viollet-le-Duc additions were removed 30 years ago. In the 60s, they erased the paintings on the walls, you know, which was painted after a drawing by Viollet-le-Duc. And what they want to do is remove more art from Viollet-le-Duc, from these chapels, you know. And we think it's the contrary. We should put Viollet-le-Duc back and not remove him, you know. They are changing the liturgy, and they say we must evolve, we must change everything because we change the liturgy. And we don't think it's good to do that because the cathedral is protected by the law. everybody is interested in the conservation of Notre Dame.
So we're talking about the interior of the cathedral, not the exterior. Pre-fire and pre-COVID, there were about 12 million people who visited Notre Dame each year. If the design that has now been approved goes through, what visually will be different for someone visiting Notre Dame?
When he enters the cathedral, he will have in front of him a baptismal bath, a big one, in the middle of the cathedral. But it is not something which exists in Catholic liturgy. So they want to do it, but it doesn't exist. So they are going to put in the middle of the nave a big work of art, contemporary art, and it will change the way we see the cathedral and the nave. And it will be contemporary art. It's not a problem to include contemporary art in Notre Dame, but what they want to do is massive, you know, it's many works of art, contemporary art. It will change completely the image we have of Notre Dame, which is a medieval building.
So after that fire in 2019, the French National Assembly passed a law that said the restoration of Notre Dame had to preserve its historic, artistic, and architectural interests. Does that law apply to both the inside and outside of the cathedral?
The law applies to the outside and the inside. The only difference is when you have a work of art, for example, paintings or sculptures, if you can remove it, if you can move it, they can move it, you know, the church can move it if they want.
Do you think the plan that has been approved now for the interior, does it comply with that law that the French National Assembly passed?
Yes, the law in France is very simple. You cannot do something, but the Ministry of Culture can tell you can do it. When a monument is classified, historical monument, you cannot destroy it. But the Ministry of Culture can tell you can destroy it. They can tell you can do it and they can do it. So we have to fight because it's only the public opinion which can prevent this to happen, you know?
Well, the restoration of the exterior spire at the Notre Dame Cathedral, it went through a similar controversy. And initially, there were plans to modernize it, but then it was decided to recreate the original spire. Is there a chance that the plan for the interior could get the same reconsideration?
Yes, we won the battle for the spire. And now we are going to win, I hope so, the battle for the inside. Because I don't understand why, because of the fire, they want to change everything in Notre Dame de Paris. They take advantage of the fire to do this, but it's a shame to do this because the fire is a catastrophic thing and they take advantage of this to do what they want. It's not a good thing to do this.
If you were in charge of the restoration, Didier, what would it look like?
If I was in charge of this, I would come back to the way Viollet-le-Duc designed the inside of Notre Dame because it is an historical monument. And Viollet-le-Duc is an historical monument. So we must be very careful with this, and we don't want to change everything. We want a restoration. We don't want a refurbishment.
Didier Reckner is an art historian, journalist, and founder of La Tribune de l'Art, speaking with us about his objections to the plan to renovate the interior of Notre Dame. Didier, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. The crowd went wild. In Saudi Arabia last night, a youth soccer team from Yemen logged a rare win. A whole lot of happiness at last for Yemen. When politics between two countries at war take a back seat, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Have more babies. That is the message leaders in Iran are sending to their people. Tehran is alarmed by a decline in the country's population growth, so the Iranian government has announced sweeping new rules on abortion and contraceptives. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Earlier this month, 25-year-old Mahsa says she realized she needed emergency contraception. Riding in a taxi in Tehran's busy streets, Mahsa tells me she had never been anxious about walking into a pharmacy and asking for any type of contraceptives before. But now things are different. Mahsa and her partner are not married, and she says they don't want children right now. It's not like they have much choice. For most Iranians, sex outside of marriage is taboo, but having children outside of marriage is illegal. Mahsa wanted to use her first name only so she could talk openly about her experience. She says she was able to get the morning after pill that day, but she wonders how available it might be in the future. This is very stupid, she says, and it puts women's lives in danger. She's referring to legislation passed last month called the Rejuvenation of the Population and Support of the Family Law. It's a lengthy document with about 100 provisions. The law bans distribution of contraceptives by public healthcare centers. It requires that pharmacies sell contraceptives only with a doctor's prescription. Abortion cases will now be decided by a panel that includes a judge and two medical professionals. Women's rights advocates are outraged about the new law. Marzia Muhabbi is a lawyer and women's rights advocate in the northwestern city of Mashhad. She tells me the new law will only lead to more unwanted pregnancies, underground abortions, and children whose parents cannot provide for them. She says the government is also promoting new incentives for Iranians to have more children. What is not clear is how the government plans to pay for these incentives. Iran's economy is struggling under U.S. sanctions. But these orders to have more children are coming from the top. The Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, wants Iran's population to grow. He has insisted on this repeatedly in his speeches in the past few years. But most Iranian women are not listening. They're having fewer kids or no kids at all. And the Supreme Leader is not happy. In this promotional video posted on his website, he says, "We haven't seen any changes, even with all my insistence. So we are requiring growth by law." For Iranians like 33-year-old Rasul, this sort of thing seems like it's right out of a George Orwell novel. Rasul, who asked that I only use his first name, says these top-down government orders are an intrusion into people's lives. Rasul lives alone, but he has a girlfriend. He says the two have decided that they don't want kids, even if they do end up getting married. Not in this economy and not in Iran. He says no kind of pressure is going to change that. Rasul says he uses condoms, and with this new law, he expects to have to pay more for them, if he can find any. As if life wasn't already stressful enough, he says. So what's behind this official campaign to boost population growth? Pardis Mahtavi is the Dean of Social Sciences at Arizona State University. She studies sexual and reproductive rights in Iran and the Middle East. She says family planning has always been a political issue in the Islamic Republic, much like in the United States.
When you look at Iran's demographics in the last 40 years, it kind of looks like a snake swallowing a rabbit. There's this bulge in the 1980s because of the pronatalist policies. And then you had a complete reversal, right, under Khatami in the 90s. And so the population rate drops off.
Mahtavi says child policy is really about maintaining power.
This really is about controlling women's bodies. What that also, though, tells us is that they're scrambling, right? So they maybe are feeling like they're losing power. And it could be one way of reading this is, okay, there's a desire to birth a new generation to indoctrinate them.
Part of the new family law requires state broadcasters to run ads like this one. It's an animation with a man talking lovingly about his big family and how having more children has brought so much joy to his life. Iranian broadcasters are also banned from airing material that promotes celibacy. Rasul and Mahsa in Tehran tell me they find the new law nonsensical and even dangerous. They say a better economy and a less oppressive government might build hope for the future, and that could encourage Iranians to have more children. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
A short update now on the diplomacy front. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is putting out an SOS to Congress to confirm Biden's ambassador nominees. He says only 16% of Biden's selections have been confirmed. Three of them had Senate hearings today. If they are confirmed by a divided Congress, they would become the lead diplomats to Germany, India, and Pakistan. It was a tragic mistake. That's how U.S. military officials described a botched drone strike in Kabul last August. It killed as many as 10 civilians, including 7 children. Afghans received an official apology in September, but this week Pentagon officials said no U.S. military will be reprimanded for the strike. Instead, the Pentagon is recommending improvements in drone strike operations. That got us thinking about how and why the U.S. military has become increasingly reliant on drone warfare. So we reached out to Zachary Kallenborn. He studies drone warfare at the University of Maryland. Zach, do you find it surprising that no one in the U.S. military is going to face disciplinary action for this well-documented botched attack on a car in Kabul?
I don't find it all that surprising. Obviously, it's a horrific tragedy, and certainly understanding what went wrong and why is something that the United States military has an obligation to do. However, the natural nature of this type of issue when we're talking about warfare is that uncertainty is the name of the game, especially when we're talking about intelligence gathering in a country where the U.S. doesn't have significant presence there really at all. And so it's natural that you're going to have mistakes like this.
So, Zach, step back a bit, and can you help us understand why the U.S. military has become so reliant on drones? I mean, it felt like George W. Bush declared his global war on terror, and suddenly there were lots of drones.
It's primarily just a product of simultaneously the nature of the war on terror and how it's been prosecuted, as well as the particular countries that we're fighting in. So Afghanistan tends to be very rocky, very mountainous, a lot of difficult terrain there. It's very difficult to have troops, you know, going up into the mountains and going into caves to try and hunt out terrorists. But it's much easier to sort of fly a drone overhead to be able to carry out strikes as needed. And so that's certainly been a big part of it. But there's also a strategic element of a major component of U.S. counterterrorism strategy has been sort of focusing on sort of chopping off the snake's head, as it were, you know, taking out and focusing on these some of these high-profile leaders. There's some controversy about how effective that is in practice, but it's clearly a big part of that.
The Pentagon has made a point of underscoring its pivot away from wars like the one in Afghanistan to free up more military resources for the Indo-Pacific region. Does that mean there will be more or less dependence on drones?
That's certainly one of the big open questions. How effective will drones be in potential conflict with states like China and that sort of thing, where they have a much more robust air defense capability to potentially shoot down these drones? But what is clear, certainly, is that both the United States, China, and other countries have been extensively building drones, not only aerial drones, but ground, surface, submarine, and everything in between, even having them interact together.
And turning back to Afghanistan, President Biden has talked about an over-the-horizon approach to keeping military eyes on Afghanistan. Will drone warfare continue there, even though with the Taliban takeover, Afghans may be hesitant to work with the U.S. government to provide any intelligence for those kind of attacks?
The challenge, as you noted, is the extent to which Afghans on the ground are willing to work with us. As we saw here in this tragic strike the other day, when intelligence goes wrong, people die, right? And if we don't have a significant presence and people on the ground don't trust us, then what rationale do they have to continue that support? So if there is that hesitancy, I would expect tragedies like this to increase.
I'm curious, how does the U.S. use of unmanned aerial vehicles compare with other countries, like China and Russia especially?
To some extent, it's just simply depend on the types of conflicts they've been engaged with. Namely, you know, when the United States has been so heavily prosecuting the war on terror, whereas China and Russia haven't dealt with it nearly to the same degree. China and Russia are more interested in, you know, preparing for potential conflict against the United States. Like, how do they rather defeat U.S. aircraft carriers, destroyers, and other types of much more complex system? And it's not like Al-Qaeda, for all their capability and horror, had anything like an aircraft carrier.
So with drones kind of being standard operating procedure for the U.S. military, I'm wondering about the economics of drones, because I see today that the United Arab Emirates has threatened to pull out of a multi-billion dollar drone deal, F-35 deal as well with the U.S. Are these drone deals big business?
No doubt. And I think that's a great example there. We're talking about billions of dollars, because what's clear is that many militaries have increasingly been very interested in drones, just as a general matter, of course. In general, they're often cheaper than some of these really exquisite manned systems like the F-35 and the F-22. And we've seen in other conflicts, particularly between Armenia and Azerbaijan, that states with drones can be very effective against states without. In that particular conflict, Azerbaijan very quickly defeated Armenia, and drones, while not necessarily the pure cause of it, you know, war is a complex matter, but certainly it was a major factor and has definitely encouraged many other states to go buy drones from Turkey, as well as many other states as well.
Zach Kallenborn studies drone warfare and terrorism at the University of Maryland. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
governments around the world are leaning hard into the idea that hydrogen energy is key to a greener future. They've dedicated tens of billions of dollars in recent years to developing green hydrogen, hydrogen power created by splitting up water molecules using renewable electricity. Today, it's just a tiny part of the world's energy mix. But watch this space, because it is expected to grow. Reporter David Kattenberg in Antwerp checked out how Belgium and Germany are already on board.
I'm in Antwerp to visit a place where green hydrogen is being produced and pumped into tanks of all sorts. I'm getting driven there in a hydrogen-powered car.
Hey, Dennis, you're in the car that says drive clean hydrogen.
Yes.
Dennis Thomas works for the U.S. company Cummins, which builds machines that produce hydrogen from water using wind and solar energy. In the fuel cell of a car, hydrogen reacts with oxygen, generating electricity and water. A few thousand hydrogen-powered cars are on European roads today, driving almost 400 miles on a tank. The challenge is finding a place to refuel. As we head out, Dennis shows me a device mounted on his dashboard.
So here I'm using an app showing like the different refueling stations we have in Belgium, right?
There are only three in Belgium. We pull into one of them on the edge of Antwerp Harbor.
This is the hydrogen refueling station here. You see CMB Tech, right?
CMB Tech produces, stores, and pumps green hydrogen, and not just for cars. Hydrogen is seen as a green alternative for hard-to-decarbonize industries like shipping, and vessels operating out of Antwerp Harbor refuel here. The company's chief technology officer, Roy Camp, shows me a front-end loader powered by both diesel and hydrogen.
So what you see on top, it's like a hood holding five hydrogen tanks. And that hydrogen is being mixed into the combustion engine. For the amount of energy it aspirates in hydrogen, it uses less diesel.
Hydrogen fuel is a clean supplement or alternative to diesel, and it's flexible. You can produce it whenever the sun shines or the wind blows, and deploy it when needed.
Maybe in the morning or in the evening, 6 o'clock, when we have 20 trucks coming by to refuel, we can all refuel them from hydrogen, which was maybe produced the day before.
The problem is that it takes lots of renewable energy to produce green hydrogen, and renewable energy is in growing but short supply. 600 kilometers from Antwerp, in the German town of Esslingen, an urban district called Neue Weststadt brands itself as climate neutral and is producing a small amount of green hydrogen. Katja Walter is helping the district and its green hydrogen company get off the ground.
We have to show that it's sustainable also in an economical way. And so we had to fund that company, and they now have to see to it that they sell all the hydrogen, that they can get all the money back that they invested first. And only if we can show that works, then this was a success.
Right now, Neue Weststadt's electrolyzers generate 90 tons of green hydrogen a year, equivalent to what two wind turbines produce. Not much. Others are producing 10 or 100 times as much. But Green Hydrogen Esslingen is selling its hydrogen to the local gas grid, displacing dirtier natural gas. Down the road, demand for its hydrogen will be greater. Under Germany's Clean Vehicle Directive, by 2030, two-thirds of bus fleets must be low emission and one-third must be zero emission.
And this is the combined heat and power production unit.
Tobias Neusser is the engineer behind Esslingen's green hydrogen company. He's optimistic about the future of this little hydrogen facility. Like all energy conversions, turning wind power into hydrogen is inefficient, only 60% efficient in Esslingen's case. The rest is lost as heat. Here at Neue Weststadt, that heat is pumped into the district's buildings, displacing natural gas and lowering heating costs.
This combination is a new approach to increase the overall efficiency, and this is a first-time realization. It's a flagship project. It's a lot of attention we receive here.
So just at the payment terminal,
It says you can refuel at pump number one.
Back at the CMB facility in Antwerp, Roy Camp fills up his car with hydrogen.
I plug it in. It's like on a pistol. Just click it in. Then wait. The counter jumps at zero.
A tank of hydrogen fills quicker than a tank of gasoline. Roy Camp likes his hydrogen car and is now set to drive close to 400 miles.
I'm happy to drive with it. I'm just waiting for more refueling stations. Yeah.
For the world, I'm David Kattenberg, Antwerp, Belgium.
After years of tense relations, Armenia and Turkey have decided to give friendship a try. Yesterday, Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Çavuşoğlu, said that the two countries will appoint special envoys and also restart charter flights. This is a big change from last year when Turkey supported Azerbaijan's offensive against Armenian forces during fighting in the contested region of Nagorno-Karabakh. We're joined now by Ani Mejlumyan. She's the Armenia correspondent with the online publication Eurasianet. Ani, Turkey and Armenia have a long, dark history. So can you explain what's going on today between the two countries?
Yes, Marco. It looks like more like a marriage of convenience. This is not really Armenia and Turkey with goodwill trying to restore relations. Unfortunately, this is not the case. What we have here is after the Nagorno-Karabakh war, Turkey had no more reason to keep the border closed. But also there is a huge economic incentive. Turkey also is trying to better its presence in South Caucasus. And by that war, it effectively managed to do that. But what it looks like from here, this is a forced situation on Armenia, especially, you know, coming with the timing. Also, Turkey still denies the Armenian genocide. And there's all these long-term, centuries-old issues with Turkey. They were reborn after Turkey showed immense help in a recent war with Azerbaijan.
So a marriage of convenience, but you also said Armenia is kind of being drawn into this. What does Armenia get out of this kind of closening of relations?
The government is trying to sell this is, you know, that economically this is going to be very good for Armenia. But the public doesn't trust those statements because Turkey is a hostile neighbor and it doesn't try to hide it even. It always supports Azerbaijan. And in close future, they're also trying to get this peace treaty, so-called, in which case, of course, Azerbaijan wants Armenia to recognize Nagorno-Karabakh as part of Azerbaijan. So this is not something that is well met in Armenia.
So, Ani, you indicated earlier some skepticism that this normalizing of relations might not happen. Why are there doubts?
Because this didn't happen before when we had less issues with each other. Back in 2009, effectively, they stopped talking about the protocols, which were to normalize relations with Turkey and Armenia without precondition. But then there was a precondition, which was about Nagorno-Karabakh, and then the deal just stopped. What we see now, especially with Erdogan's politics, just doesn't help people to see this, that this is going to happen with good faith. A lot of people think that this is a very fragile deal if it's going to happen.
Some headlines have suggested that this deal happened because Turkey wanted to please Joe Biden. Did the U.S. play a role in this change in relations between Turkey and Armenia?
We keep hearing about that. I think Biden definitely has more invested interest in general in South Caucasus than Trump had. But at the same time, we have to see more because U.S. is not at the table, is not part of anything. The Minsk group, which is U.S. is a part of, doesn't have any role at this moment. The format still exists, but there are no negotiations for the moment within that format. The things have changed and regional players want to play by themselves in the region. For now, U.S. is not part of the conversation.
So we've got to see how this actually unfolds, or as you said, even if it happens. Still, though, for Armenia and Turkey, two countries that have not traditionally gotten along, how significant is it that they seem to be moving towards normalization?
Because all of this is happening in such a hostile environment, and there is no time for any real dialogue, the mood is not festive, and it wouldn't be either way, because what actually Armenia has to agree to if they're going to normalize relations with Turkey? This is what Armenia worries about. For Turkey, they don't have much to worry about because they are in a very strong position, especially right now. What we don't want to do, just put ourselves in an even worse position, and this is security-wise. In general, normalization of relations between neighbors is a good thing. just like our government points out, but we have to understand that we're not dealing with just any normal neighbor, and this is no longer is a 100-year-old issue. There has to be established some sort of trust. And that hasn't happened before, and that's not the case at all for now.
Ani Mejlumyan is the Armenia correspondent with the online publication EurasiaNet, speaking with us about Turkey and Armenia attempting to normalize relations. Ani, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
From the debate over deep-sea mining to the Christmas tree shortage in Canada, plus a story about how a theater company in Belarus fled the crackdown on political opposition, you can catch up with the latest stories reported by the world's correspondents around the globe. Head over to our website. That's theworld.org. Soccer, the beautiful game, brings out emotions. The excitement of competition, heart-pumping pride in your team, and the sheer thrill of seeing athletes in top form. Last night, a game in Saudi Arabia had all that, plus a spectacular burst of hope, as the youth team from Yemen scored its first goal against Saudi Arabia. Yemenis are happy, happy, happy with this goal, so said the Saudi sportscaster. Now, let's remember that Saudi Arabia has been at war in Yemen for more than 6 years, a war that splits Yemen right down the middle, politically and geographically. To oversimplify, perhaps, southern Yemenis are grateful to the Saudis for their military support. Northerners hold Saudi Arabia responsible for what's been called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But last night on the pitch, that story took a backseat.
It was something that we were waiting for a long, long time. We were looking for any small light of happiness. And yesterday, our junior national team made us very, very happy.
That's Yemeni journalist Ahmed Bider, who was watching at home with his wife and son. He said they were jumping and shouting as Yemen's junior football team defeated Saudi Arabia's to win the West Asian Cup. People from all parts of Yemen were doing the same. Crowds poured through the streets of the southern port city of Aden, where many see Saudi Arabia as an ally. In the northern capital, Sana'a, the scene was the same. In streets where Saudi bombs have fallen, there were explosions of celebratory gunfire.
There are people who had fireworks. Everyone was happy, shouting, running in streets. So that was something that we never, ever forget. We are very proud of our junior national team, and we are looking forward for a better football future for Yemen.
Yemenis had a hopeful moment yesterday, a rare taste of happiness, and a chance to remember what national pride feels like, even as Yemenis remain at war with themselves. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.